it was such a harmless day, you know what I mean? It was just like, it was actually one of the first like sunny days, really like kind of warm days of the year. And we were just out for a spin. It was lunchtime, Saturday lunchtime. And when I was catching back up with her, I turned the corner and I saw her bike, and it was, you know, crushed. Like, I've never seen a bike broken in so many places. A car with a big dent in the front of it, the windscreen was smashed, and the kind of scary part of all of that was that she was nowhere to be seen. And it's kind of like, you know, it's hard to even remember exactly what happened, and, you know, even my memory of the whole event is sort of in pieces as well. But like, I just remember first of all thinking that, like, you know, this, oh, like, there's been a bike crash, like, I've crashed myself, I've fallen off, I've been in crashes in races, she's been in crashes in races, she's been in crashes with traffic, and you didn't really think anything, you know, of it. Like, and in hindsight, when I think back and I think of the state of the car and her bike, I think, well, how did I not know something more serious was happening? But I didn't, and I started calling for her name, because, as I said, her body was nowhere to be found. And I was just like looking for her, and she actually was quite far away from the bike in the end. And, you know, it was good 20-30 seconds of calling her name before I saw her, and she was upside down in the ditch, and, you know, her body in not a nice way, you know, twisted, neck twisted. She had quite serious wounds, and I probably didn't even fully kind of comprehend how bad it was even at the time. I just jumped in the ditch, and I didn't even, like, at that point, I didn't even think anything fatal had happened here, and I just wanted to pick up her hand and just tell her, like, oh, everything's going to be okay, you know? But, you know, picked up her hand, and it was just floppy, you know what I mean? There was nothing there, and I checked for a pulse on her wrist, and no pulse, and I checked for a pulse in her neck, and no pulse, and I just started doing CPR to her. I just started pumping her chest, and, you know, kind of like the image of that, well, I mean, like I'm suffering a lot with whole PTSD of it, and that image comes back, and, you know, I can still picture the feeling of, like, the feeling of pumping her chest. And I just didn't know what to do, and I, you know, it's such a surreal moment to be in, and it almost feels like it didn't even really happen, like. And then some people who passed by, there's a couple of other cyclists and drivers that passed by while I was doing that, and we were waiting for an ambulance, and they got a defibrillator. And so I cut open her jersey, her cycling jersey, to stick the defibrillator patches on. But basically, all I revealed from cutting her jersey open was there was no skin there, and all, you know, down to, like, all the top of her chest just ripped off, and there was nowhere to stick to the patch, you know, from all the skin. And I think it was at that point I just gave up, and I just fell down on the ground outside the ditch and just fell into a heap and started just bawling, crying, and just screaming, and I don't know even what.
Of course.
I can't even remember that after that.
Did you call anybody at the time? Were the first people you reached out to?
Yeah, I called my dad. He came down. The driver had called the ambulance. So they were on their way, and I called my dad, and he came down, and I mean, like, it's very hard for him also, because, like, you know, when you, like, we were together for 7.5 years, and that's a long time for people our age. Like, she was only 24, like, and, you know, she became like a daughter to my parents as well, like, you know. And it's obviously very hard for him to be there and see what he saw, and everything as well, and seeing me in the way I was, and it's just kind of like, what do you do then? Like, you know what I mean? We just sat on the edge of the road, and we were there for a while, and the guards were, you know, asking me just who she is and her name and address and all that stuff they have to do. And then I didn't want to tell anybody. I didn't want to, you know, let anyone know until I'd broken the news to her parents, because I think they deserve to know, and I didn't want them hearing through some news article or through someone else. And so we just, the first thing we did was just got in the car. I left my bike there, and we drove up to her parents' house, which was like half an hour away, and still in all like my cycling kit, and I had Gabrielle's blood on my hands and arms and all down my legs as well, and just knocked on the door, and had to break the news to them as well, that, you know, what had happened. And that's horrible, you know, and I even get flashbacks of that drive, having to do that drive, and you know, you're about to ruin their lives with the news, and like, you know, it's, yeah.
Yeah, with 15 minutes going to that match, I was leaning up against the post. Clare were totally in control. I remember looking up to the stand. I actually ended up getting sunstroke the same day. But I was talking, my uncle was doing steward behind the goals, and I said to him, I said, "'Tis time to be booking the holidays, I think." And next minute, Barry Foley just started smacking balls over. And then it all became very real. And next minute, Kerry plucked the ball out of the air and took off running, and I was in direct line with him, and he was weaving. He looked like he was going to fall over three or four times.
Yeah,
I suppose no one from Clare could really put in the challenge, because it was probably going to be a foul. And next we saw him going over to his weak side, and I'd say every Limerick player went, "Oh God, no, don't." Because Gary, as good an all-a-holler as he was, his weak side, probably 7 out of 10 he'd meet him on the meet. But next one, you can even see by the strike, it kind of looped over the bar. But the magnitude of what he did, Joe, was, myself and Kieran would normally be the last two into the dressing room, and we walked in anyway, and we sat down, and the players of today will probably cringe at it. We pulled out the fags and we had a fag. And sat down, and I, next minute he took off his boots. And when I say there was no skin left on the soles of his feet, I mean they were raw. Mm-hmm. Because the ground, as Jamesy will allude to that day, it was concrete. And Kerry wore rugby studs in every game he played. The big, long steel rugby studs. So let's say 20, 25 minutes earlier, this man had gone up the field, did what he did with no skin on the soles of his feet. I remember going up to the showers with him after, and he had his hand on my shoulder, and he was trying to find a bit of skin that wasn't damaged to limp up into the showers. It was phenomenal what he did. I don't think there's too many players in the history of the game, or that will ever play the game again, that would be able to do what he did that day. It was phenomenal.
So before we go any further with the show, there is a point I really want to make here. I made it in December, and in light of the Athletic piece on Vera Pei yesterday, I think it bears repeating more strongly, and it is a point I feel very strongly about. I'm not really in the habit of doing this, but I think the FAI need to be held to account here. So, in my opinion, the FAI's handling of the Vera Pau controversy is unacceptable. Completely, utterly unacceptable. The FAI, I think you'll agree, has a duty of care to the players, and from what I can see, they are not upholding their duty, and they haven't upheld their duty over the last number of months. Now, I should say, this is not an attack on Vera Pau. But as you know, last December, the American National Women's Soccer League published a report into an array of issues in US coaching. Some of those issues were as serious as being criminal, and some were about improper conduct as applied to Pau. So in that report, and in yesterday's article in The Athletic, what we have are players and coaches saying one thing, about what happened, and we have Vera Powell saying completely the opposite. There is zero common ground, and it makes for a very frustrating read. How are any of us to know the truth? None of us were in Houston. But let's recount the timeline here, because I think that gets to the nub of this issue. Back in December, the very night that report was published, within a couple of hours, the FAI released a statement of support. And so that very night, Roy Barrett, in a press conference, was asked about the report, understandably. Here's what he said. The reality is that Vera has denied the allegations, and the report does not make any comment one way or the other. They just state the allegations from anonymous people. Vera's refuted them, and they move on. Vera denies it, and I have no reason to disbelieve that. Now, in the Athletic piece yesterday, Vera Powell gives her version of the FAI's handling of that report back in December. So the FAI asked her about the allegations, and according to Powell, quote, I responded and they looked me in the eyes and they saw what it did to me because I'm so different. So it's double standards. If I would have been a male, this would never, ever have been an issue. Now, I'm sorry, Roy Barrett saying we asked her, she denied a case closed, or Powell's they looked me in the eye and case closed is just not good enough. It's nowhere near good enough. And on Roy Barrett saying that the authors of the report just simply quoted people anonymously and didn't make a finding either way of guilt, there is some truth in that, but it is worth stating, in that report, the authors, who are serious people, they make the point they didn't name coaches lightly. They make a strong point of saying that, and they listed out the criteria for naming people, and they felt confident it was correct to include Vera Powell. So Roy Barrett's comments in December really do omit that point. It wasn't just a case of we took anonymous voices and we threw everything into the report. On the back of the Athletic piece, again, an FAI statement of support straight away in the last couple of days. The FAI said it remains fully focused on supporting Vera and the women's team as they continue their preparation for their first World Cup in Australia, and we won't be making any further comment on this article. This is crazy. This is not how this situation should be handled. What should have happened in December and what should happen now is very simple. And it's not a short statement with no follow-up questions. It's not a chat with a player or two. And it's not Vera Powell having a chat, for sure, with the player. It should be an independent person, not an FAI employee, face-to-face conversation with every player who's played under Powell, completely confidential, and just a very simple, tell us your experience. Is everything okay? Completely confidential. And then compile a report, present it to the FAI, present it to the Irish people, and ideally then the report says, we've talked to the players, we are absolutely certain everything is A-OK. Everything has been done here to a standard. And if they did that, I think the Irish public would be totally fine and behind Vera Powell. Because let me put it this way. If any board member of the FAI had a daughter or a loved one in the Irish team on the back of this report, the first thing they would do is exactly what all of us would do. They would phone that loved one and say, is everything OK? What's the experience? Talk to me. Now, the FAI has not extended all the players in their care that courtesy.
To any 7-year-old, it was more anything is possible. That every, I meet kids after races now, and I was no different. Looking for pictures, looking for to sign, you know, piece of paper to sign things. Like that's everything is possible. It's just hard work and discipline, like, and enjoyment and getting fun out of it. Because I think that's all any athletes that are, that's all I did along the way, and I know the same for Kieran McGeehan and probably the same for Rashida, that, you know, we all just wanted to, we had a dream, and the most important thing is as a kid to have a dream. And I take, you know, great privilege in the position I'm in to get to be, you know, at this position of my life and still be living it. And yeah, I think dreams, they get bigger and bigger. But fundamentally, to actually, you know, be able to live out your childhood dream is something a few people are afforded. And to get to do that, I am very, very grateful.
You couldn't really be living the dream much more than what you're doing right now. This is a fantastic momentum of results that you've had, and to be able to back it up, because sometimes, you know, you could have a good run at the Europeans, qualify for the Olympics, and maybe the performance drops off. But even what, we've got 10 days out now from the Morton Games, and it feels like this summer, like, you were on a really good run of form.
Yeah, I think there, you know, the only way to describe it is surrounded by something very special. It has been a difficult few months, as I'm sure many people are aware, but I do feel that I take great honour every time I get onto the track to to represent everyone in my life very proudly and to do my utmost. I think that's what's really important to me. I'm very much taking everything day to day and living in the present moment, not getting a day or two ahead or a step or two ahead. And I think that in itself is leading itself to quite good performances because everything is very acute. So, yeah.
Like, to be very sensitive about this, I'm very sorry about Craig's passing, and I think it affected everyone in our sport at the time. And I thought you spoke wonderfully afterwards as well, talking about the fact that you always felt that he's still there, he would want you to be achieving right now, and that he would have went along to even the smallest indoor events to support you along the way, and you still feel that very much is in your presence. I think it's a beautiful thing to be. I think what you've just alluded to there, that you still feel that he's very much looking down on you and wishing you well as you get ready for this adventure in Paris as well.
Yeah, for sure. Craig was an incredible sports person and an amazing ambassador for Ireland. He achieved on the biggest stage you possibly could achieve. You want to do him proud, you want to do his family proud. And yeah, of course, I miss him every single day. And yeah, it's just knowing that he lived out his childhood dream and he would want me to do nothing else.
Yeah, I think he'd be incredibly proud of Thank what you. You've achieved this summer and what you're going to achieve beyond this as well. I would think the Athletics community has probably been very important around you at that time too, has it?
Yeah, the Athletics community has been fantastic. I think there's even in Monaco last week, the amount of Irish flags. I don't know, there must have been a lot of Irish people down the south of France on holidays that decided to take a trip to Monaco for the Athletics, but it was a fantastic evening. But I did have to smile when I crossed the line. I said, gosh, I think the only country flags I could see that were out in abundance seemed to be the Irish flags.
I just want to say about John and Liam, they're two of the greatest minds on football. Not just being great players, but being great analysts. What's going on? Why is this match not working out? Who's doing what? They buy that, and to let it breathe and give it time. It's precious to everybody who was watching. The game is for the people. It isn't for people on television or for Ronaldo. It's actually to help people understand and enjoy, you know, the way you've done on Virgin with brilliant yourself and three brilliant analysts, Shane Horgan, you know, Rob Carney, and Matt Williams. This is adds to the enjoyment. We're not important.
Yes.
But Liam came on and his brilliant brain and his rigor and his capacity. Three North Side guys who could express themselves without the gibberish.
Go on, Eamon. North Side.
No, it's right. It's right. In England, you get fellas who are great players. They can't put two words together. And I hated that because it wasn't representative of us.
Yeah.
And I wanted it to be representative.
Yes.
And here was three kids who never got second level education. Go, baby.
Yes.
Sorry.
I'm sad to say our time is coming to a close. This has been very special. It's been great to have you here. I think everybody would agree to have the guys here is just amazing.
But can I just say something here?
Of course you can.
I think it's great to see the audience here. And this is obviously for Liam. Liam was one of our great players. We were on the panel for years and we got on well. But this is for Liam.
Yes.
Liam was great. Great player, a great panelist, and a great individual.
Now, if you... Whatever about Dunphy, if you start getting emotional, we're all going to be toast here now. Liam, the night has been about you, and rightly so. Maybe a word on these two gents, either side of you, and what they've meant to you.
Big part of my life, big part of my life since 1998.
you know, well, Eamon was a terrible part of my life earlier. But, you know, from 1998, big part of my life, great fun together, great crack together. Just hit it off, all three of us. Yeah. Not a good panel. Great panel.